this. He marched around to the side of the car where Savannah was sitting, opened the back door, and bent down to look at her. She still hadn't even undone her seatbelt. She sat with her hands pushed hard into the centre of her stomach, as if she'd just that moment stabbed herself. His impatience dissipated. "Savannah," he said gently. She looked up at him with unshed tears in her eyes. She blinked blonde eyelashes. The tears spilled. Troy couldn't stand to see a woman cry. "You're safe," he said. He hunkered down next to the car so they were face to face. "You've got us." "I know," she said. She wiped her cheeks and fiddled with the tarnished silver antique skeleton key that hung on a cheap chain around her neck. "I like your necklace," he said. He'd learned this from Amy's meltdowns. Redirect her focus. "Thanks." She dropped the key. "Does the vine symbolize something?" He pointed at the tattoo on her forearm. Green tendrils curled around her purple-veined, stick-thin arm. He had no problem with tattoos. Amy had a few. But this one, though in itself innocuous, seemed a desecration of her childlike arm. "Or did you just like the look of it?" "It's Jack's beanstalk," she said. "Huh," he said. He tried to remember the fairy tale. Jack climbs the beanstalk and steals the giant's gold? "So it's about achieving your dreams?" She didn't look like the type for self-help books and vision boards. "It symbolizes escape," she said. "Right," he said. "So, speaking of which, let's get in and out of this place as fast as we can." He went to offer his hand, but then thought better of it. Too domineering. He dropped his hand by his side, took a step back and waved his hand in a courtly, over-the-top, "This way, madame," gesture. "Give her space. Don't rush her. Try to understand." She undid her seatbelt, swiveled, and slid from the car, smiling tremulously up at him as she put her thumbs in the loops of her jeans and hitched them up around her waist. "Sorry," she said. "I know you haven't got all day."
"Yes, I do," said Troy. "It's fine."
He hoped the boyfriend was here and gave him an excuse to grab him by the shirt and slam him up against a wall like a cop in a movie. "Before we go up, perhaps we should check for his car." She delicately touched her nostrils and sniffed.
"Good idea," said Troy.
Logan didn't speak. Troy bounced lightly on the balls of his feet. He was suddenly, unexpectedly jubilant. They followed Savannah to the undercover parking area. She stopped, and her shoulders sagged.
"It's fine. He's not here."
She pointed at an empty space in the far corner.
"Okay, so that's good," said Logan. "Great."
Troy felt himself deflate. Now this was back to being a boring errand to endure. He looked at his watch. He actually did not have all day.
"There's something wrong with you," his mother once said to him as she drove him home from school after another suspension. "There's something very, very wrong with you."
"I know," he'd thought at the time, pleased.
The three of them went up in the lift to the third floor. Troy looked at the mirrored walls and saw 100 reflections of himself and Logan getting tinier and tinier, but always towering over Savannah. She led them down a carpeted hallway with the familiar lemon air freshener smell of this kind of well-kept, mid-level apartment block and unlocked a door.
"Please come in," she said shyly, as if this were a social visit.
The first thing Troy saw was unframed art leaning against the walls. Proper art. Abstracts with violent strokes of paint so thick and textured they still looked wet.
He had not been expecting art.
He's an artist. Savannah followed Troy's eye. Amateur artist. There wasn't much furniture. A battered double-seater leather couch faced a television leaning against the wall. A tacky-looking glass coffee table contained half-empty takeaway containers, chopsticks shoved upright into the fried rice, an open newspaper stained with blotches of soy sauce, a half-drunk bottle of Corona with a piece of lime floating in the remaining beer. A stack of unopened removalists' boxes sat in the corner of the room. This was a man who unpacked his art before he put up his television. A man who carefully cut up a piece of lime to put in his Corona, but left his half-eaten takeaway dinner on the coffee table. A man who hit his girlfriend. Savannah shook her head at the food on the coffee table and made a move towards it as if she were thinking about cleaning it up, then stopped.
"So these two boxes are obviously yours," said Logan.
He nodded his head at two of the removalists' boxes, one of which was labelled Savannah Clothes and the other Savannah Recipe Books.
"Yes," said Savannah. "Yes, thank you. Much appreciated."
Much appreciated. The cadences and colloquialisms of her speech slipped back and forth, one moment 20 years old, the next 80.
"Let's get everything out of here and in the hallway," said Logan.
He and Troy carried out the boxes. Troy got the box of books, which made him stagger.
"You right, mate?" asked Logan, straight-faced.
They came back in to find Savannah squatting on the floor in the tiny kitchen, all the cupboard doors open, as she filled a box with saucepans, fry pans, and a blender.
"I like to cook," she said to Troy, as if explaining herself.
"So I've heard," said Troy. "Mum and Dad might keep you permanently."
"What else?" asked Logan.
"In the bedroom," said Savannah. She looked up at them. "The glory box at the end of the bed. It was my grandmother's." She winced. "It's rather heavy." They went into the musty-smelling bedroom, the bed a tangle of sheets and blankets and pillows, clothes strewn over the floor.
"This must be it," said Logan.
He experimentally lifted one corner of the mahogany chest at the end of the bed.
"What the hell?"
A bare-chested man sat upright from the tangle of sheets. Troy's heart leaped. He grabbed the nearest thing he could find from a bookshelf and held it up like a weapon.
"Don't fucking move!"
Logan dropped the chest with a bang.
"Stop right there, mate," he said,
his demeanour as calm and controlled as a country cop, his voice as deep and slow as their father's. People often said Troy and Logan sounded like their father, but this was the first time Troy had realised just how much Logan sounded and even looked like their dad. The man scuttled backward up the bed until he was sitting with his back against the wall, his hands clutching the bedsheets. He was scrawny, pasty white with lots of black chest hair, and he wore a pair of faded checked boxers with ripped elastic. Troy felt a revulsion so visceral, it made him shudder.
"I've about 100 in cash," the man said.
He reached over for a wallet on his bedside table and held it up.
"That's all."
He had an Irish accent. Troy's first girlfriend once said there was nothing sexier than a man with an Irish accent, and Troy had been personally offended by the existence of Ireland ever since.
"We don't want your money," said Troy, disgusted.
"What the?" Savannah appeared in the doorway.
"Savannah?"
The man picked up a pair of glasses on his bedside table and put them on. Now he looked like Harry Bloody Potter.
How dare he look like Harry Bloody Potter? Harry Potter would never hit a woman.
"Where have you been?" he said to Savannah, as if Logan and Troy weren't in the room. "I've been out of my mind." Why aren't you at work? Said Savannah. Her eyes darted about the room. She looked terrified, and her terror ignited a flame of red-hot fury in Troy's chest. I'm as sick as a dog, said Harry Potter. He put his hand to his stomach and a queasy expression crossed his face. Dodgy, sweet and sore.
Your car isn't there, said Savannah. It broke down on the motorway, in the rain. Everything has gone to shit.
His face twisted with remorse. I'm so sorry, Savannah, my love, for that night. That was unforgivable, I know, but I wasn't myself. I was upset about... But that's no excuse. I know it's no excuse.
He suddenly seemed to remember the presence of Logan and Troy.
Who are these guys?
They're friends, said Savannah coldly. They're helping me pick up my stuff.
Is there much else? Logan asked her.
Friends? From where? Asked Harry Potter.
It doesn't matter where we're from, said Troy. We're just getting her stuff and getting out of here.
Savannah grabbed a suitcase from the corner of the room, wheeled it over to the open built-in wardrobe, and began to fill it with clothes, chucking them in, still on their coat hangers.
But where are you going? Asked Harry Potter. Where are you staying?
He made a move as if to get out of bed.
Stay right where you are, said Logan.
The guy looked panicked.
Savannah?
Don't talk to her. Don't say another fucking word. Troy walked to the bed and loomed over the little fucker with the full might and power of his fit and healthy 6'4" body. His nostrils twitched at the faint smells of vomit and sweat. She doesn't owe you an explanation. Troy was showered and clean and wearing a $900 shirt and a Louis Moinet watch, and he might have made some bad choices in his life and he might right now be facing an ethical dilemma of monumental proportions because of those unfortunate choices. But he had never hit a woman, and he never would. He had inherited not a single one of his villainous grandfather's villainous genes, and he liked the fear and confusion on Harry Potter's face. Harry Potter deserved to feel fear and confusion because he was legally, morally, and spiritually in the wrong. It happened so rarely that you knew that you were right and the other guy was wrong. Troy was Spider-Man, the Hulk, Captain America. He was goddamned Batman. He had never felt better. Chapter 17. Now. So, she sends her sons over to pick up this girl's stuff. Doesn't know her from a bar of soap, but she lets her move in. It was late afternoon, and the packed salon hummed with the roar of multiple hairdryers. Senior stylist Narelle Longford only half listened to her 3 p.m. half-head highlights as she prattled on about Joy Delaney. Nearly every one of her clients had been prattling on about Joy Delaney over the last week. Joy was well known in the local community.
It has to be connected, don't you think? This strange girl and Joy's disappearance?
I don't know. Narelle removed the towel turban from the woman's head. Isabel Norris was known to be difficult about her colour.
Wait, don't you normally do Joy's hair?
Isabel spun her head to look at her.
You probably know more than me. Have the police talked to you?
No. Narelle plugged in the hairdryer. Smooth, with a bit of volume.
Did she tell you she was planning on going away?
She didn't, said Narelle.
I heard that Joy and Stan were having issues. They were barely speaking.
I don't know anything about that, said Narelle, who knew all about that.
Did she ever mention that girl to you?
Savannah, said Narelle.
Wait, did you meet her? She met Isabel's eyes in the mirror. I did. I cut her hair.
Did you? Isabel looked animated. I heard she was a little, you know.
She mouthed the word.
Slutty.
She seemed nice, said Narelle.
It's all tied up somehow, said Isabel. Too much of a coincidence. Strange young girl moves in and then the wife vanishes. Don't be surprised if the next thing we hear is that Stan just happens to be in a relationship with this girl now he's got Joy out of the way. Ow! That's a bit hot on my ear.
Sorry, said Narelle unapologetically.
She was Joy's confidant and confessor, as bound by secrecy as a priest or lawyer. But if Joy missed her next appointment, Narelle would go to the police and hand over 30 years of secrets. She'd tell them about the betrayals, the ones referred to obliquely and the ones discussed in frank detail. She'd give the police everything they needed to convict her husband. She would say, here is one possible motive and here is another. Because any marriage of that many years has multiple motives for murder. Every police officer and hairdresser knows that. Chapter 18. Last September. It was close to midnight, and Amy Delaney, oldest daughter of Stan and Joy Delaney, part-time taste tester, part-time normal person, part-time not-so-normal person, sat cross-legged on her unmade bed, naked, her hair in a perky cheerleader's high ponytail, looking at the poem she'd just written in her journal. Her bedroom was at the very top of the inner-city terrace she shared with three flatmates. Red and blue neon light from the sign above the miniature golf course next door flickered across the page as she read, "A strange girl. There is a strange girl in the house where I grew up, sleeping in my discarded bed, wearing my discarded clothes, making lasagna for my discarded mother. And my mother had to go in the middle of my call. I still had things to say, because the strange girl called out her name in two syllables, as if she had the right. My mother's name is Joy, and when she answered the strange girl, her voice was full of joy." Amy languidly drew thick rectangles over various words in her poem, as if she were a wartime censor, tore out the page, crumpled it up, and ate it. She didn't specifically remember eating paper before, but she must have, because the taste and texture was familiar. She chewed carefully, swallowed. If she was rating it at work, she would have said it was pasty, bland, difficult to swallow, with a chemical aftertaste. Apparently Steffi, her parents' dog, had developed a fetish for paper. There was a name for it. Her mother had told her all about it. Ever since she'd retired, Amy's mother brimmed with facts. She listened to podcasts, clicked on BuzzFeed articles, and Googled. Then she called up her children and passed on all the new facts that she'd learned. It was interesting to observe her mother's personality changing after retirement. She'd always been the busiest person Amy knew, impatient and distracted, and now she'd become so uncharacteristically reflective, willing to engage in very long, meandering conversations about topics she would have once deemed frivolous. "Mum needs to do some kind of course to occupy her mind," Brooke had said, sniffily. "She's doing a course. She's learning how to write a memoir," Amy told her, "except she says she's never going to write one." "Thank God," said Brooke. "I'd read it," Amy had said.
Amy had always been interested in who her parents were before they became her parents. Joy Becker, before she became mum. Stan Delaney, before he became dad.
Both Amy's parents were only children, with beautiful, complicated mothers, mothers who should never have become mothers. Her father's mother had a scar that trailed down her wrinkled right cheek from where she'd been thrown across the room by Amy's grandfather. Supposedly, that was the first and only time Amy's grandfather had hurt his wife, and Amy's grandmother immediately chucked him out, and that was that. But Amy thought there had to be more to the story. She'd given her father a book about a man who finally speaks about his troubled childhood to his oldest daughter, in the hope that her dad might speak about his troubled childhood to his oldest daughter, her. But so far, he couldn't make head or tail of it. "I don't know why you thought Dad would suddenly start reading novels," Brooke had said, pleased that Amy's plan hadn't worked, because she believed that Dad belonged to her. "Did you think he'd join a book club when he retired?" Then they had both got the giggles, imagining their huge, taciturn father in a book club, chatting about character development over Chardonnay. "He watches TV now," Amy had pointed out. "He never used to watch TV." "I know," said Brooke. "He told me this long, complicated story the other day about a family where the youngest son had died in a car accident. It turned out he was telling me the entire plot of a movie. I thought it was real." That was a few months ago now. Brooke was too busy to talk much these days because she was starting her own physiotherapy practice, which was a big step. And knowing Brooke, it would turn out to be a proper grown-up success. And Amy was proud of her little sister, although also mystified. Like, why do that to yourself? Had Brooke never noticed how the Delaney family business had controlled their lives? The paperwork, the stress, the requirement for all four children to help out. Once, when Amy was a teenager and in the middle of studying for a history exam, an exam she was destined to fail because this was the first time she'd even cracked open the textbook, a kid had come into the house and imperiously demanded Amy make her a sandwich, as if Amy were her servant, and Amy had very nearly got up and made the sandwich before she came to her senses and told the kid to get lost. They could never escape it. When they were growing up, there was a family they knew who had packed up their three kids and gone travelling around Australia for a year in a caravan. Amy had been temporarily obsessed with that family. She thought it sounded like a dream. "He'll never catch up," her father had said. He was speaking about the middle kid in that family, the only one who was any good at tennis, and therefore the only one who existed. But her dad was wrong. The kid came back, he kept playing, he didn't do that badly, ranked in the top 200 at one point. "We should go travelling around Australia," Amy had said to her mother, and her mother had burst out laughing as if she'd made a clever joke. Now Brooke was doing exactly the same as their parents, filling her pockets with rocks before she waded out into life. Brooke was meant to avoid stress because of her migraines, not chase it, but she'd always been a martyr. Amy remembered Brooke as a little girl, high pigtails and reflective sunglasses. "She's got a headache," Amy would say to her mother, watching her. "What? No, she doesn't. She hasn't said a word." But Amy could tell. There was something about the way Brooke walked when she had a headache, as if her head was in danger of rolling off and she had to keep it balanced on her neck. And Amy wanted to cry for the poor little kid walking out there with the weight of everyone's expectations on her shoulders, as if she already knew she would end up as the last hopeless hope for the Delaneys. Amy's parents could read their children's games with perfect accuracy. They could predict their every shot, exploit their every weakness. But in other ways, they were clueless, blinded by their love of the greatest sport ever invented. Maybe it was the migraines that made Brooke so serious. Amy wished she could take them away from her. She remembered Brooke when she was a baby, dark curly hair in a top knot, only two chipmunk teeth. She never crawled, she bum-shuffled. It was hilarious to watch. Now look at her, so serious, so married, her shoes so sensible, her bra strap so beige. You'd think she was 50, not 29. Had Brooke ever danced all night? Had a one-night stand? Brooke would say these were not examples of a life well-lived, and maybe she was right. But Amy blamed those cruel migraines for aging her sister beyond her years. Amy threw her journal on the floor and lay back down in the cold flood of air from her open window. Her three flatmates were all out. She'd moved here 6 months ago, and she'd thought that with three flatmates, she'd rarely have the place to herself. But, in fact, she often seemed to be the only one at home. It was cheap rent because the neon light from the sign lit up her room like a disco. For the last year, she'd been keeping herself afloat with a cobbled-together series of part-time jobs. She'd finally accepted that regular full-time work was not for her. It wasn't a matter of finally settling on the right career path. The right job didn't exist. Full-time work caused a kind of claustrophobic terror to build and build within her chest until one day there was a humiliating emotional spillage that resulted in her termination or resignation and her parents looking distressed when she said the new job hadn't turned out to be so wonderful after all. Now her most regular work was three-hour shifts a week as a taste tester or a sensory evaluator if she ever wanted to sound more impressive, which she never did. She joined a group of university students, young mothers and retirees to taste and discuss food with immense seriousness. She wore no lipstick or perfume or hairspray. She drank no coffee nor chewed gum beforehand. She sat at a laptop, logged in, spun around on her chair, and waited for the kitchen staff, dressed in black, to bring out trays of labelled food. There was no right or wrong. There was no winning or losing. It was very important, but also of no consequence whatsoever. No one got upset, except for the occasional roll of the eyes if someone went on and on making their impassioned point about lemongrass to the panel leader. There was also that one time an executive stormed out because none of the taste testers liked the bolognese sauce he'd spent a year developing. But that had been exciting. In between taste testing shifts, she did market research and product testing work. Today, for example, she'd spent an hour as part of a focus group discussing toilet paper. It was cash in hand, the sandwiches were excellent, that was lunch sorted. Everyone was extremely nice and polite when you did focus group work. She didn't care that it was fake. It was soothing. She got to walk into a lovely plush office in the city like she was part of corporate Sydney, and then walk right out again and go to the beach. This afternoon, she'd filled in a long questionnaire about her thoughts on deodorant, and in return she'd received a department store voucher that she'd used to buy two bras on special. It felt like she was getting away with something, like she was living by her wits, picking pockets in Dickensian England. She also had a theory that this sort of work was good for her mental health because it forced her to make multiple choices. Do you prefer spray or roll-on? With or without perfume? And when she was sick, she found choices impossible. She could stand in a grocery store staring at a shelf, paralysed with indecision. She hadn't yet found a therapist who fully endorsed this theory. She would be 40 next April. She wasn't sure how that had happened. She could remember when her mother turned 40, and it had seemed ancient. Amy had assumed there would be flying cars by the time she turned 40. 40 was too old to be eating bad poetry for dinner, to be living in a share house with 20-somethings, to have no savings or furniture or boyfriend. She and Brooke should swap lives. except that if Amy was married to a man as deeply enamoured of his own supposed intellect and supposed wit as Grant Willis, she would have to answer yes to that ubiquitous question, "Have you been experiencing suicidal thoughts?" She reminded herself to get herself a new boyfriend soon, so she wouldn't wake up alone on her 40th birthday. Would this strange girl, this Savannah, still be living in Amy's old bedroom by her 40th birthday? She listened to the panicked scuttle of a possum's paws as it ran across the roof tiles above her head. Her heart raced within the cavity of her chest, and her thoughts scuttled as fast and as foolish as 100 panicked possums. "It's your fight-or-flight response," explained each new therapist, kindly and patronizingly, as if this were a brand new concept for her. Often, they spent precious, expensive minutes of the session explaining how cavemen needed the fight-or-flight response because of the saber-toothed tiger. But now there was no saber-toothed tiger, but still we responded as if there was one. They were always so excited by the tiger. And Amy would drift off, thinking about how there could be occasions in the modern world where you could actually face a tiger, like if you are on safari, for example, or if one escaped from a zoo, or how a rapist could represent the tiger, and you needed to race off down the alley, and how she was fast. She was a fast runner, faster than most. She would get away from any rapist or tiger, but she could never get the fuck away from her thoughts, her crazy, stupid thoughts. And next thing, time was up, and that will be $3,056, thank you, and our next available appointment is in 3 years' time. Shall we book you in? She did the 4-7-8 breathing technique. Breathe in for 4, hold for 7, out for 8. In for 4, hold for 7, out for 8. Her heart rate slowed from full-blown panic to an acceptable level of high alert, as if she were no longer running from the tiger, but she'd climbed a tree and was watching it circle and snarl below. She hadn't climbed a tree in a while, but she used to be good at it. She yawned hugely. "Don't fall asleep in the tree, Amy." Tomorrow was Father's Day. She needed to sleep. She had to be up early to make chocolate brownies. Her dad loved her chocolate brownies. If she stayed awake all night, which was a real possibility, she'd have dark circles under her eyes, and her mother would notice and worry. Or perhaps she wouldn't, because she would be so busy noticing and worrying about Savannah, who had proper problems, like homelessness and abusive boyfriends. She considered her options to make herself sleep. Sleeping pill? Hot bath? Hot milk? Guided meditation? Orgasm? Really boring book? One of her flatmates read giant hardback biographies of important men, and they were so boring they made Amy want to weep. Her dad said he played imaginary tennis in his head when he couldn't get to sleep. Amy said, "Doesn't that wake you up?" Her mother suggested doing the ironing. Amy couldn't think of anything less restful than playing imaginary tennis, and she never ironed. "That's evident," her mother said. Amy rolled onto her side, adjusted her pillow. She might love this girl who was trying to steal her parents. This savannah from the savannah where the saber-toothed tiger roamed. When she asked Troy about Savannah, he said she was fine, which was the word he used when a waiter asked, "How was your meal?" And Troy thought it wasn't that great, but it wasn't bad enough to get all Gordon Ramsay about it. Logan said he had no opinion on Savannah. She could hear his shrug. Brooke would be meeting Savannah for the first time tomorrow too, but when Amy last spoke to her, she said that she'd spoken to Mum and she wasn't worried and Amy shouldn't worry either, and that their parents were doing something nice for a domestic violence victim and they should all feel proud. Amy had never had a boyfriend hit her, although she'd had a couple who fucked her when she was too out of it to consent, but that was before consent got fashionable. Those kinds of incidents used to be considered funny. even hilarious. The worse you felt, the louder you laughed. The laughter was necessary because it put you back in charge. You didn't remember, so you created a memory you hoped was the truth. Sometimes she kept dating a boy, temporarily convinced herself that she loved him, just to keep the correct narrative on track. Well, no need to go all the way back there. Her mind was filled with catacombs it was important to keep sealed shut, like the sealed-up fireplace in her parents' living room. The brick hearth where her grandmother had smashed her face was long gone. She thought of her grandfather, her father's father, who nobody talked about because of what he'd done. She would have liked to have at least seen a photo of him. "Why would you want to see his photo?" her younger siblings said, disgusted with her, because their grandmother made extraordinary apple crumble and palmed $5 notes into their sticky little hands, as if she were tipping them. He just interested her. Did he regret what he'd done? Did he ever do it to another woman? She assumed her interest in her dead abusive grandfather indicated a pathological attraction to bad men. "Sleep, Amy, sleep." She heard a door slam downstairs, so that meant one of her flatmates had come home, which was good. No need to imagine robbers in black balaclavas wandering through the place and getting frustrated when they couldn't find anything to steal except $40 biographies. Breathe in for 4, hold for 7, out for 8. Supposedly, people in the military used the 4-7-8 breathing technique and got to sleep in under a minute. "Let's start with sleep," her latest therapist had said. His name was Roger, and she wasn't too sure about his qualifications. He probably read about the breathing technique on the internet. She liked the fact that there was something a bit dodgy about him. She felt more comfortable in his slightly dingy office than she did in the softly lit, plush-carpeted offices of the expensive psychiatrists and psychologists, who she felt were judging her hair and clothes. She didn't actually expect Roger to cure her. It was just so that when people said to her, as they inevitably did, "I think you need to get help, Amy, professional help," she could answer, "Sure, I'm getting help." She moved through therapists like she moved through boyfriends. She dumped both boyfriends and therapists when they offended her, enraged her, bored her. The boyfriend said she was a head case, a nutcase, a drama queen, a psycho. The therapists said she had ADHD or OCD, depression or anxiety, or most likely both, a nervous disorder, a mood disorder, a personality disorder, maybe even a bipolar affective disorder. The word disorder was a popular one. There was one guy who announced there was nothing at all wrong with her, she just needed stress relief, and then he texted her the following week and asked her out for a drink, which he said would be fine now he was no longer treating her. The fact that she said yes to the unethical sleazebag probably demonstrated that there actually was something very wrong with her. "Medical diagnosis isn't in my scope of practice," the new guy, Roger, said anxiously when Amy asked, mildly interested, which particular diagnosis took his fancy. "I'm a counsellor. I work alongside the medical profession, and I work alongside you." Then he smiled and leaned towards her, confidentially, as if he were sharing a secret, no longer anxious. "You know, sometimes labels are a distraction. You're not a label. You're Amy." Hokey but sweet. It actually did feel like he was sitting shoulder to shoulder with her, on the same team, rather than simply observing her with the cool professional eyes of some of his colleagues. She liked him. For now, at least. She only sometimes took the tablets the good psychiatrists prescribed, and she only sometimes took the pills the bad boyfriends offered. Every now and then she pulled out the hopeful, obligatory mental health plan she and her GP had worked on together, and she did her best to keep up strategies and techniques that made her appear semi-normal to the world. Poetry, journaling, exercise, mindfulness, nature, meditation, breathing, berries, vitamins, superfoods, probiotics, gratitude, baths, conversation, sleep. Sometimes they worked and sometimes they didn't. "It's just that your feelings are too big," her dad's mother told her when she was a kid and cried for so long her parents lost their tempers. "You'll grow into them. My feelings used to be too big too. Have a lemonade, sweetie." Apparently, her grandmother didn't so much grow into her feelings as flatten them with alcohol. But alcohol and lemonade only amplified Amy's oversized feelings. "Oh, Amy is just nervy," she once overheard her other grandmother, her mother's mother, say. "Like Auntie Edna. No need to get your knickers in a knot, Joy. She's fine." "Gee, those nervy types do get on your nerves, though. Should we ask her to cry somewhere else?" Auntie Edna spent the last days of her sad, nervy life tied to a chair. But no need to get your knickers in a knot. "We won't let you be tied to a chair, darling," Amy's mother used to say. "Anyway, I actually think you're more like Auntie Mary, and she didn't end up tied to a chair." Auntie Mary was killed after she stepped in front of a tram in the city, but she absolutely didn't step out in front of that tram on purpose, no matter what some people implied. The truth, according to Amy's mother, was that Auntie Mary got distracted trying to save a little girl's Panama hat when a southerly buster blew it straight from her head one summer afternoon a week before Christmas, which, according to Amy's mother, was exactly the sort of reckless thing Amy would do. And if she did, Joy would never forgive her. Look both ways, especially when Christmas is coming up. Make that one of your funny little rituals. Looking both ways. Amy didn't have any funny little rituals at the moment, or none that people would notice. Anyway, they all had their rituals and superstitions, their strange little habits. Troy had to tap his nose 3 times before he served. Logan had to wear his lucky red socks whenever he competed, even when his feet grew too big for them. Brooke still had trouble getting out of the car whenever she arrived somewhere. Brooke thought no one knew that. Amy knew. "There's nothing wrong with you, sweetheart," her father said. "It's all in your head." All in your head. Her dad was so cute and clueless. She lay still and breathed while she chatted with the spirits of Auntie Edna and Auntie Mary. She had never met either of her mad great aunts, but she felt like they would have got along. "I've kind of got a bad feeling about this girl staying with my parents."
"Me too," said Auntie Edna.
"Me too," said Auntie Mary.
"Get rid of her," said Auntie Edna, who was bossy.
The bad feeling intensified, took hold of her stomach, twisted. A car alarm started up down the street. Someone knocked on her bedroom door. Amy grabbed at the sheets and pulled them up, covering her nakedness. "Who is it?" she called out.
"Sorry," said a deep, hoarse male voice. "It's just me."
He paused.
"Simon."
He cleared his throat.
"Simon Barrington."
As if there were several Simons living in the house. She looked at the ceiling. She'd kind of known this might happen, and she told herself that under no circumstances should she let it happen.
"Are you awake?" he said through the door.
"No," she called back. "I'm not awake, Simon Barrington." "Just lying here chatting to the spirits of my crazy dead aunts, Simon Barrington." She wouldn't say anything else. It was a mistake to sleep with your flatmates.
especially when they were still in their 20s and you were on the cusp of leaving your 30s. Simon's long-term girlfriend had recently dumped him while they were out at Yumcha. He'd been going out with her since high school, and they were meant to be getting married next year, and he didn't see it coming, and he loved Yumcha, which his girlfriend knew, so that added an extra layer of tragedy. Now he was broken-hearted and drunk, and he'd come home and remembered his single flatmate on the top floor, like remembering some leftover takeaway in the fridge, and he'd thought, huh. He was a nice enough guy, sweet and polite and scrupulous about housework, but he read those boring biographies all the way through to the end, and he was an ex-rugby player with a rugby player's top-heavy body. She liked tall, lean, inscrutable men. There was nothing inscrutable about Simon Barrington, and he had a boring job she could never remember, something to do with telecommunications or property, or possibly he was an accountant, and he was younger than her and shorter than her, and men always said they didn't care about the height thing, but they did, they surely did, and that repressed fury always came to the surface eventually. So it would be once, and it wouldn't be good sex, and then there would be awkwardness between them for the next 7 months of her rental agreement, and then she'd have to find somewhere else to live, and she liked it here. She liked the neon light from the miniature golf course. She liked the possum with the panic disorder. "Sorry," Simon called through the door. "So sorry. I'll go." She waited. There was silence. Had he gone? She should let him go. She got out of bed, put on a t-shirt, and opened the door. He was walking towards the top of the stairs. "Simon?" she said. "Simon Barrington?" He turned. His shirt was pulled loose from the waistband of his jeans. His glasses were askew. His eyes were bloodshot, and he was in need of a shave. She lifted her finger, beckoned. Impulse control disorder. That was another one. Chapter 19. Now. A phone rang. A printer whirred. A keyboard clacked. A man laughed and said, "You're kidding me." A woman sneezed and said, "Bless me." It could have been any open-plan corporate office on a weekday morning, with its grey nylon carpet tiles and beige walls, except that the people working here routinely dealt with the worst of humanity. It was no wonder the most senior of them spoke in similar brittle, impatient tones that made their partners sigh, "Why are you always so cynical?" Christina sat at her desk, drinking a full-cream double-shot piccolo from the cafe next to the station, thinking about Nico this morning, sighing, "Why are you always so cynical, Christina?" when she questioned why his friend of a friend, wedding photographer, was demanding payment up front. Joy Delaney had been out of contact for 13 days following an argument with her husband. This was a woman whose children couldn't recall her going away for one night without her husband. "Why are you always so cynical, Christina?" "Because nice, ordinary people lie and steal and cheat and murder, Nico." They'd paid the photographer up front. She drank the last of her piccolo, opened the file in front of her, and read a printout from Joy's Word documents on her desktop computer. "So you want to write a memoir. Writing a memoir is an enriching experience. Think of this exercise as a warm-up to get those creative juices flowing. Let's start with your elevator pitch. Tell us your life story in just a few paragraphs below. My given name is Joy Margaret Becker. No relation to the famous tennis player Boris Becker, in case you're wondering. But I am a tennis player. My mother's name was Pearl, and she was a beauty, which is why she never quite recovered from the shock of my father walking out on us when I was 4 years old. He said he was going to meet a friend, but he didn't mention the friend lived over 2,000 kilometres away in the Northern Territory. My father died in a fist fight 3 years after he left us. He had a quick temper. I have a quick temper myself, or so I've been told, but I've never been in a fist fight. I was always told that my father adored me, but that sure was a funny way to show it. My mother moved back in with her parents, my grandparents, who were more like parents to me, and brought me up. I was especially close to my grandfather, who was the chattiest man I have ever known. He could talk the hind legs off a donkey. I still think of things I'd like to tell my grandpa. My mother was quite a critical, unhappy person. It wasn't her fault. She was born in the wrong time. I think if she was born now, she might have been the CEO of a big corporation. Or she might have been a weather girl. She was certainly pretty enough and always very interested in the weather. My grandfather loved tennis, and one day when I was a toddler, I picked up his big wooden square-headed tennis racket. It would have been so heavy for a three-year-old. My grandfather, just for fun, threw me a ball, and I hit it straight back. He said he nearly fell off his chair. I hit 10 balls in a row before I missed one. My grandmother said it was only 5. My mother said she didn't believe a word of it. Who knows? All I do know is that tennis was all I wanted to do when I was a little girl. I just loved hitting that ball. Hard, flat shots from the baseline. That's my favourite. Too much spin these days. It's the fancy new rackets. I loved the sound. Clop, clop, clop. Like horses' hooves. The smell of new tennis balls is one of my favourite smells. I have never taken drugs, apart from paracetamol. I do quite enjoy paracetamol, but I sometimes feel like tennis is my drug. When the match is over, it's like waking up from a beautiful dream. I started entering tournaments when I was 10. When I was 11, I played against a 13-year-old girl, and she cried when I beat her. I didn't feel sorry for her at all. I remember that very clearly. My prize for winning that tournament was an umbrella. See-through with a red trim. That was the same day I overheard a man tell my grandfather that I had the potential to be a world champion. That stuck in my mind. My grandfather and I had a plan. First, I would win the local junior championships, then the state titles, then the Australian women's singles, then I'd go overseas. I'd never been on a plane, and win the French and US titles, and finally Wimbledon. By the time I was 12, my grandfather had to build a new shelf for all my trophies. I was quite young when I married a tall, very tall, dark and handsome young tennis player called Stan Delaney. We planned tennis careers. We drove all over the country playing in tournaments while still trying to support ourselves. It was hard, but fun. I did a secretarial course after school. My mother wanted me to have a backup in case tennis didn't work out. Her hope was that I would marry a businessman. She thought tennis was a fairy tale, and perhaps she was right, because my husband had a very bad injury when he was only 22. He tore his Achilles playing the third set of the Manly Seaside Tournament quarterfinals. He would have won the match if not for that injury. So that was his Achilles heel. But it was his Achilles tendon. So we left the circuit, and a few years later we started Delaney's Tennis Academy, which went on to become one of the most successful tennis schools in the state, if not the country, if I do say so myself. I told my mother that I ended up becoming a businesswoman myself, but she thought I was trying to be funny. We had 4 children, 2 boys and 2 girls. Even Stevens. All 4 were very talented players. We have no grandchildren as yet. We recently sold the tennis school, and now we have the time to tick things off our bucket list. If only we had a bucket list. Oh well. Christina?
She looked up to see Ethan in a turquoise shirt today at her cubicle entrance, gleaming with health and optimism.
"These young guys are like fucking Energizer bunnies," one of the other detectives had sighed to Christina, and he was 15 years older than her, but she knew what he meant.
"Joy Delaney's internet search history for the day she disappeared," said Ethan, handing her a sheet of paper. He'd highlighted relevant lines in yellow. Joy had Googled the following questions. How do you know when it's time to divorce? Divorcing after 60. How does a divorce affect adult children? Does marriage counselling work? Does whiskey go off?
So much for that wonderful marriage of theirs, said Christina.
I know, said Ethan sadly, and he momentarily bowed his head as if to honour a loss. But then he immediately lifted it again and said brightly, I've also got her phone records. 1 hour before she sent that text.
If she sent that text, said Christina.
1 hour before that text was sent, Ethan corrected himself, there was a 40-minute telephone conversation with a Dr. Henry Edgeworth. He's a 49-year-old plastic surgeon, married with 2 children. He's currently overseas and not returning our calls.
A plastic surgeon? Christina frowned. How does that fit?
It didn't fit.
Booking in for plastic surgery so she could change her identity, suggested Ethan.
Yeah, because she got mixed up with the mafia, said Christina.
Should I look at potential connections with organised crime? Asked Ethan enthusiastically.
She looked up to see if he was joking. She couldn't tell. She said evenly,
We need to look at all potential connections.
Ethan nodded. He looked down at his notes. There was that huge hailstorm 2 days after Valentine's Day.
So you're thinking she got hit by a hailstone and now she's got amnesia?
He looked up at her. Now he couldn't tell if she was joking.
She said, How are we going with that house guest of theirs?
I'm closing in on her.
Good, said Christina, because I reckon all roads lead to her.
Chapter 20. Father's Day. On Father's Day morning, Joy woke late and well rested. She was sprawled face down right in the middle of the bed like a child. There was a little circle of saliva where she'd dribbled onto the sheet. Stan wasn't there. Spring sunshine poured through the window, warm on the skin of her legs, which were bare beneath her t-shirt. She could smell jasmine from the garden and bacon from the kitchen. Savannah must be cooking breakfast. She was getting far too used to having someone cook and clean for her. This was what it must be like to be a celebrity. No wonder they were so charismatic and cheerful on talk shows. Joy could feel herself becoming more charismatic and cheerful by the day. In fact, Savannah seemed to treat her and Stan as if they were talk show guests and she the host, fascinated by the intricacies of their celebrity lives. She wanted to hear everything about them, their tennis, the tennis school, the club, the children. She asked questions Joy was sure her own children had never bothered to ask. When did you know you were right for each other?
The first time I saw her, said Stan.
He was sitting when he said this, and Joy was standing, and he grabbed her by the waist and pulled her to him so that she landed on his lap. Joy saw their marriage through Savannah's young, interested eyes. Solid and valuable, like an antique, burnished with age and wisdom. Savannah probably coveted a relationship like theirs, a relationship that produced children and a beautiful house and a successful business and shelves full of framed photos of birthday parties, Easter lunches, and Christmas mornings.
Joy stood under the shower, tilting her face up to the spray, and thought about the shameful moments that were never photographed. Her own face ugly with rage, spit flying from her contorted mouth. The back of Stan's head as he walked away. Sitting in a car on the side of the road, four children silent with shock in the back, while her heart thudded in rapid time with the click-click of the indicator. She shuddered and got shampoo in her eye. Of course they wouldn't share the nasty secrets with Savannah. There were limits to their honesty, no matter what was going on with their elderly frontal lobes. The shampoo stung like hell. She blinked furiously and massaged in the expensive volumizing conditioner her hairdresser, Narelle, had told her to use every third day. Narelle's recommended hair care regime was complex, but Joy got a lot of compliments for her hair, and she loved Narelle like a sister, or the way that sisters should love each other. Her own daughters absolutely loved each other, but one was generally offended or incensed or bewildered by the other one at any given time. The price tag for the shampoo was still stuck on the back of the bottle. Stan would say, "What's it made of? Gold dust?" Joy peeled it off with her fingernail, rolled it between her fingers, let it fall, and nudged it with her toe down the drain. Yes, Savannah certainly did not need to know how many times Joy and Stan had fallen in and out of love over the last 50 years, how there were times when Joy hated Stan so passionately it made her sick to the stomach, how when the older three were very little, they'd talked seriously and matter-of-factly, almost pleasantly, about separating, how Joy had believed it was definitely going to happen, how Brooke was a surprise baby conceived during their surprise reconciliation, how it had truly felt like a brand new relationship, how getting so close to losing each other had made them settle into something deeper and richer. But then, yet again, they'd lost their way, and all that love and happiness drained slowly, imperceptibly away, as if there was an invisible, tiny leak. Amy once told Joy that she had no idea how lonely it felt to be single. Joy had wanted to tell her that you could still be lonely when you were married, that there had been times when she had woken up day after day, crushed with loneliness, and still made breakfast for four children. She didn't say that to Amy. She said, "Yes, darling, you're right. It must be so hard." You couldn't share the truth of your marriage with your adult children. They didn't really want to know, even if they thought they did. There was one year, a really bad year, when both her mother and Stan's mother were sick, and then both of them died within 3 months of each other. As only children, Joy and Stan had to grieve alone. That was when Joy made a secret plan to leave. Her idea had been to wait until Brooke finished high school, at which point her mothering duties would be discharged. It had given her pleasure to plan it all out, even to imagine the pain of it, like a sadomasochistic fantasy. But then, Brooke finished high school, and they were good again. Maybe even better than they'd ever been. They got back into doubles and won tournament after tournament. Winning seemed to permeate everything, their sex life, the business. Joy focused on squeezing money from the tennis school. She opened the cafe and the pro shop. She introduced the holiday camps. That's what happened. You had a long streak where you felt like you couldn't lose a point, until you did. Now, here they were. She couldn't exactly say if Savannah had caught them on an upswing or a downswing, or if they'd finally found an equilibrium that would last them until death did them part. Sometimes it felt like their relationship ebbed and flowed over a day, or even a conversation. She could feel affection followed by resentment in the space of 10 minutes. She went to rinse off her expensive conditioner and then remembered Narelle had told her to leave it on for at least 3 minutes. She decided to spend the 3 minutes doing ankle dips with her eyes closed, which was what Brooke had told her to do every day to improve ankle mobility. She wasn't nearly as obedient with her daughter as she was with her hairdresser, and she wanted to be able to truthfully tell Brooke today that she'd been doing her exercises. She bobbed up and down on one leg, eyes shut, hands outspread, just in case she needed to save herself. Brooke might not approve of her doing these exercises in the shower. If Stan came in and caught her doing her wobbly, naked bobbing, he would laugh and laugh. Would today be okay? She felt strangely nervous about it. Of course, the boys had already met Savannah when they helped her pick up her things, and that had all gone fine, although it turned out the ex-boyfriend had been there, but he hadn't given them any trouble, and everyone's limbs were intact. Perhaps Savannah and the girls would become friends. Probably not Brooke. She was so busy with the clinic, and she could be standoffish. On the other hand, Amy collected new friends of all ages, wherever she went. She once made such good friends with her Uber driver that the driver parked her car and joined Amy and her other friends on their night out, and it was all thanks to this nice Uber girl that Amy had found her current share house. Maybe Savannah could move into Amy's share house if another room became available. Although, frankly, Joy was in no hurry to have her move out. Joy stopped bobbing, rinsed off the conditioner, and gave herself a final blast of freezing cold water, which supposedly caused her stem cells to form brown fat instead of white fat, and brown fat was good, apparently. She would ask Brooke about brown fat today, and Brooke would probably laugh at her and say she'd got it all wrong. Joy tried to make Brooke feel clever and medically qualified as often as possible. Brooke was clever and medically qualified, just desperately in need of approval and desperately trying to hide the desire so naked on her darling frowny face. If only she'd wear a little lipstick. Joy dried herself briskly. Goodness, she really did feel nervous. Was she worried the children would notice the misalignment between the good-humoured, loving selves she and Stan were portraying to Savannah and their true selves, the ones they'd grown up with? But come on now, they were happily married for the most part, and they were good-humoured and loving. Or Joy was, anyway. All four of her children each fervently believed in separate versions of their childhoods that often didn't match up with Joy's memories, or each other's, for that matter. Sometimes one of them would tell a story about an incident that Joy was positive never happened, or at least not in the way they described it, because she had biographical facts at her disposal. But we weren't even living in the Fairmont Street house then. But your grandmother wasn't alive when you turned 13. And sometimes they'd argue about which of them was the villain or the victim, the martyr or the hero. That wasn't you that got stung by the bee helping Grandma after she fainted at Troy's party. It was me. And Joy would think, it was Logan's party, not Troy's, and there was no bee, it was a wasp, and no one got stung. Amy just thought she did, and none of you helped, and Grandma didn't faint, she passed out drunk. Her children refused to be corrected. That's what they remembered, therefore that was what happened. And when their memories didn't match up with each other's, they held on tight to their versions of the stories, as stubborn as their damned father. Although sometimes one of them would get a far-off look and you'd see something click into place and they'd re-examine a childhood event with grown-up eyes and say, wait a minute, maybe Grandma was drunk that day. Joy put on her dressing gown to go into the kitchen. For the first few days Savannah was staying, Joy had made sure she was fully dressed before she left her room each morning, but it was funny how quickly she'd begun to feel relaxed around her.
Most house guests, no matter how pleasant, gave you a sense of something being out of place, so that you only relaxed fully when they were gone. But Savannah had slotted into their home so seamlessly. Joy noticed that Savannah never closed her bedroom door at night. Not even a little bit. She went to bed with the door wide open, so that if Joy went to bed later than Savannah, it was like walking by the bedroom of a small sleeping child. "Good night," she'd call out, if Savannah had the bedside lamp on. "Good night, Joy," Savannah would call back cheerfully. "Sleep tight." It came to Joy with sick clarity that the poor child had probably learned the art of fitting in when she was growing up. She hadn't said all that much about her childhood, but she had told Joy that she'd grown up in the foster system. She said some of her foster homes were great, fantastic, but some were not so great. She'd been moved many times because there were relatives who agreed to take her on, but then it didn't work out, or they changed their mind. She said that, to be honest, those were the living situations that were not so great. Savannah didn't know anything about her biological parents, although she vaguely remembered some supervised visits with her biological mother, but those had stopped when she was very young, and now she had no idea, and not much interest, as to the woman's whereabouts. Joy combed her wet hair. She'd blow dry it after breakfast. She was starving. She looked at herself in the mirror. Did Savannah cook for Joy and Stan to make them like her? The awful thing was, it did make them like her. Was that another hair on her chin? For goodness sake, where were the tweezers? She put on her glasses, leaned in close, and removed it with one tiny violent tug that brought tears to her eyes. It would be terrible if Savannah was cooking to buy their affection. They weren't fostering Savannah. She was a grown woman. But still, Joy needed to be mindful of her background. She readjusted the tie of her gown. A day like today would be so hard for Savannah. She would have to see Joy's children celebrating their father with gifts and jokes, when she had never had a father herself. Joy had never had a father either, but she had grown up in the one home with a mother who loved her, albeit in her own peculiar, not especially loving.